and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report from a German Member of Parliament who met with Edward Snowden in Moscow that the NSA leaker offered to testify in front of Congress and did not see himself as an enemy of America. We will speak with constitutional lawyer Bruce Fine, who up until recently was a lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. His latest book is American Empire Before the Fall, and we will discuss the extent to which the public outrage over spying on Americans that led to a close vote in Congress to curb the NSA's collection of metadata on U.S. citizens has been lost amid the almost daily stories about the NSA spying abroad, revelations that are likely to become even more sensational since Glenn Greenwald has promised that the worst is yet to come. And then we will hear from retired CIA officer turned political activist Ray McGovern, who recently met with Edward Snowden in Moscow. McGovern helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he joins us to discuss the issues surrounding Snowden, who is either considered a hero by some or a traitor by others, or both. Then finally, with Secretary of State Kerry in Cairo expressing guarded optimism that the Egyptian generals will return democracy to their divided country, we will speak with the filmmakers of the new feature documentary, The Square, the definitive documentary on Egypt's revolutionary uprising that continues beneath the surface while it has receded from the headlines. Jahan Nujaim, the director of The Square, best known for her film The Control Room, joins us along with the producer Karim Amer to refocus on the Arab Spring and a revolution that is not going away. And joining us now is Bruce Fine, a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel to the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and he's authored several volumes on the U.S. Supreme Court and the United States Constitutional, helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton, and is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was up until recently the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fine.
Thank you, Ian.
And Bruce, it's with the German parliamentarian saying that Edward Snowden doesn't consider himself a traitor and wants to testify before the Congress. You represented his father up until recently. Do you think he got so far away from his initial mission pronouncement that he wanted to alert the American people to constitutional violations that the NSA was doing domestically. So it seems that the focus has gone now on foreign intelligence, and it seems that that Edward Snowden's fate is even more remote from the possibility of returning to testify here in the United States. So you've been on the inside to some extent. How did it all get so lost, if that's the right term?
Let me state at the outset, I believe that Ed Snowden certainly did a public service for the American people insofar as he was disclosing the National Security Agency's dragnet surveillance of American citizens without any probable cause, without any suspicion of implication in crime. It seemed clearly to be a violation not only of the Fourth Amendment, which, generally speaking, requires some suspicion before you can invade the privacy of Americans, but also the provisions of the Patriot Act, which required some relevance to a terrorist investigation before you could seize information about Americans. Remember, the Fourth Amendment, the Supreme Court has held, applies to protect American citizens, not only at home but abroad, but it does not apply to foreigners who have no loyalty to the United States. Their allegiances are elsewhere. They don't obey our laws. They don't pay any taxes. It may be foolish to spy on them, but you're not exposing anything like a legal violation when you identify Angela Merkel or other leaders that have been targeted by the NSA for intercepting their communication state. It may be foolish, but it's not a threat to the rule of law. That's where things began, but I think that things seem to have drifted, as you say, away from what I believe is a constitutionally protected disclosures of information that identify government illegalities, the things seemingly very far removed, as you're indicating. And if we can go back to Edward Snowden's, I think, very dramatic interview that he gave to Glenn Greenwald in Hong Kong, where he said if he wanted asylum, he would want it in a place that the treasured freedom of speech, a freedom of association, rule of law, and he identified Iceland. And he ends up not in Iceland or anything like that, but in Russia. Russia, a place that doesn't protect free speech. Anyone who dissents from President Putin is soon found in jail and accused of embezzling billions of dollars and whatever. And moreover, once he is granted asylum in Russia, we have statements from President Putin that the asylum wasn't granted because Russia believes in anything Edward Snowden has done. In fact, Mr. Putin said there are no NGOs in Russia, that if Edward did what he did in the United States as a Russian citizen, he'd be imprisoned. Putin said he was sympathetic to the U.S. effort to try to imprison Edward, but he would keep Edward here as a pawn in bilateral relations as leverage against the United States. And so that Edward Snowden is now knowingly being used against the United States, and no one has to be exceptionally prescient to know that Mr. Putin is going to use that leverage not to promote freedom, but to promote the interests of Russia, which is what you would expect. And then the last portion, among others, that seems to me questionable is the revelations of the interceptions by the NSA of four leaders. It's not just Angela Merkel, the leader of Brazil, and then we have Mexican leaders or otherwise. Those are not even close to any legal violation of any sort whatsoever. So why are you, those are not constitution protected disclosures of government illegality. It may be government stupidity, but the fact is these foreigners are using this information not to advance the freedom in the United States or our rule of law, but they have their own agendas that are at work here. And it would seem to me a little bit odd that Sir Edward would want to go to Germany to disclose information about spying that's legal under American law against the Germans, and yet he's not in the United States testifying with the ongoing deliberations in Congress about protecting American citizens under the Fourth Amendment from NSA's overreaching. Now, and I want to underscore, too, I would understand at the outset that given the repeated statements by high-level officials, senators, and even the Secretary of State really convicting Edward of treason, illegalities before you had a trial, there'd be some hesitation. I wouldn't recommend anyone coming back and getting a show trial rather than a due process trial. But I would think it would behoove Mr. Snowden to have an attorney in the United States and set forth these are the parameters that guarantee due process. An impartial jury, an impartial venue, you know, no pretrial treatment like Bradley Manning or now, I guess, Chauncey Manning, but indicating that, yes, just like Socrates took the verdict at the Athenian jury and didn't escape into exile, like that, an opportunity to preserve the rule of law, those kinds of negotiations would be indicative of an understanding that you just can't have every person decide for themselves what is legal and what is not. That would be the opposite of the rule of law. So all these considerations, you know, raise serious questions. And certainly we have had good things happen from the Snowden disclosures because it does appear that we'll have a legislative change of some sort out of the Senate and House that the President will sign. But it seems, as you point out, it's gone way beyond that. And the sensationalized and, I think, melodramatic disclosures of, you know, you now know that maybe Angela Merkel ordered a certain kind of sandwich or whatever, and making that seem like it's a crack in the rule of law in the United States when it really is no such thing.
Again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fein, constitutional lawyer, formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall. He's been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was up until recently the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. So how did the Snowden story get overwhelmed by Glenn Greenwald and WikiLeaks? They've become the face of it all. It's really difficult to know what situation he's in. I did an interview about a month ago, I think now, with the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who made the charge that he thought Snowden, the whole Snowden affair was a classic textbook Russian intelligence operation, that he was recruited in 2009 in Geneva, and that made sense to somebody from that world. I got a lot of nasty responses just for simply exploring that idea, which is what my job is here. I'm a journalist, not a propagandist, so I have to look into whatever people tell me. So what's your opinion on how the message got lost?
Well, I don't know, Ian, whether there's a single narrative that connects all the dots here. I do believe that WikiLeaks had ulterior motives. Julian Assange is from Australia. He has no interest in the United States Constitution. He probably doesn't know what it is. And in my judgment, he attempted to exploit the circumstances to raise money for WikiLeaks. I do not believe that Julian Assange is someone who is seeking to implement an enlightened system of a rule of law. And he just himself, in his own characteristics, seems to display a tyranny and a one-man rule that's the opposite of what he says he seems to be against. And the other element, you know, Glenn Greenwald, I mean, Glenn is very smart. I think he's done some great things. It does seem to distract attention when you're doing book deals and selling movie rights and even searching for payments to have interviews with Edward that would indicate that there's more than the public interest that's involved, which to me is disturbing here. It's so important that we focus solely on what's important for the United States, the American people, the system itself. And you don't want it. Once you start commercializing an issue, then, in my judgment, the whole issue then turns no longer into one of principle, but, you know, how can I twist it, turn it, promote it, inflate it to make money out of it, which is a tawdry exercise that I think would have horrified the founding fathers and those who drafted the Fourth Amendment.
Well, but isn't this likely to the problem you're having with it is that the focus has shifted away from NSA's violations of the rights of Americans and of the Fourth Amendment, etc., to the revelations about spying abroad. These revelations are likely to become even more sensational because Glenn Greenwald has promised that the worst is yet to come. So the drip.
In my judgment, Ian, the smart thing to do, why don't we just, there's no interest, in my judgment, for U.S. citizens being, you know, concerned about spying on Angela Merkel or the other leaders. I would be stunned if their intelligence agencies in these countries didn't tell their leaders, you know, everybody's going to be trying to spy on you. That's hardly novel. What is novel is American government treating its own citizens as terrorists or, you know, presumptive traitors or terrorists, and spying on them, and that needs to be addressed immediately. The right to be left alone is so precious in a democracy where you don't feel inhibited about criticizing government for good or for ill. You have that right to be left alone so that you can chart your own destiny. That's the idea of liberty in a free country. And to say, I don't know that anybody in the United States really feels that they are protected against Russians or the Chinese trying to spy on them. You know, they're adversary governments. That's what you'd expect. But heck, the government of the United States is our government. We are the people. We are the sovereign. And that's what makes so outrageous the spying on Americans. And I agree with your suggestion that once you have a torrent of foreign intelligence collection making headline news and they're a little bit sexier, then it diminishes the focus and the momentum and the understanding about how terrible and menacing the domestic surveillance is, because they don't have, you know, the sex appeal, and that's wrong. Even if you're just trying to utilize your control over the chronology, you'd save that till after we've satisfied and fixed the spying on Americans first. You got it through the legislative process, the court system, and then this other stuff, which is of no urgency whatsoever in terms of fixing for Americans, can wait.
So what's your sense then, Bruce Fine, of given that you feel that the message has gotten lost and that some good can come out of this in terms of reform, particularly of the National Security Agency. The chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has expressed a lot of anger, so there's talk of somehow reining in General Alexander, or perhaps firing Clapper. But in terms of structural reform, is anything that
in some sense, it's a little bit alarming to me, because if what we end up with, Ian, is a system, Dianne Feinstein, well, all right, don't spy on foreigners, but spy on Americans. I mean, then it makes up being worse than where we started out. And that is a real prospect. We know of the competing bills out of the Senate responding to Mr. Snowden's disclosures. One is at least reasonably good, the Senator Leahy bill out of the Judiciary Committee, that basically would shut down the domestic metadata collection on innocent American citizens and build in some better safeguards with regard to hearings before the now secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. But the competing bill proposed by Senator Feinstein of the Intelligence Committee would ratify the Fourth Amendment violations, which would be worse than the situation that obtained when Ed Snowden made his revelation. So it is very critical that the attention and focus be on the domestic surveillance now and make sure we win that battle rather than have... I'm sure that President Obama would say, all right, listen, I'll stop spying on the leaders abroad, but hey, Americans are fair game. They're the ones that I need to control because they're the ones that have power over my political fate. I mean, that would be a disaster. It needs to be the opposite. Go ahead and surveil the people are not Americans. Their allegiance are elsewhere, who are belong to other countries abroad. But the domestic surveillance, that's us. We're all presumptively loyal. We pay the taxes. We obey the laws. We expect to be treated as free to do what we wish unless you have probable cause to think we're implicated in crime.
Well, apparently the exposure of the NSA spying has eroded global trust in American brands, and that a lot of international companies are leery of doing business with American companies simply because they feel that their data is being compromised.
Well, that's true, but that's a commercial issue. We may lose money, but we're talking about liberty and the Fourth Amendment. And the fact is, if we build in back doors, traps that enable us to using American companies to spy on foreigners, that may lose money, but it's not a constitutional violation. It may be prudent to stop that kind of thing for trade purposes. But in my mind, that is secondary. We don't put the Fourth Amendment up for sale and decide whether we do or do not authorize the government to use things depending upon how much money we think we could lose. This is who we are as a people. The right to be left alone, Ian, was the spark of the American Revolution. It was the running and rummaging through American homes and businesses by petty officers of the British looking for contraband or tariff violations that sparked the American Revolution. And here we're going to surrender that we're making a monetary calculation. That was not the Constitution that was created in 1787. It wasn't the country that people sacrificed for at Valley Forge to win. And we shouldn't accept anything less today.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Bruce Fine.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and he also helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton, and is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was up until recently the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with retired CIA officer turned political activist Ray McGovern, who recently met with Edward Snowden in Moscow.
see me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under seven U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. He currently heads the Speaking Truth to Power section of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. And in 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. He recently met with Edward Snowden in Moscow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Ian.
And tell us about your meeting. It was described in the New York Times recently when they did an article on Edward Snowden and whether or not he's going to be working for some internet company in Moscow. That described the meeting where you went in a van with blackened windows and sounded like your old days in the intelligence world. What were the conditions of the meeting, and how did you get there, and what was your general impression of who's in charge, if you will? Does the FSB control Edward Snowden?
Well, getting back to the blackened windows and this kind of thing, none of us told any New York Times reporter that we went with blackened windows. It was not the case. We were taken to a place where we met Edward Snowden, and we had a very, very warm award ceremony where we gave him the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. And then we kicked back with him for about 5.5 hours, had a nice dinner, and compared notes with all that was going on. He, of course, was interested first and foremost in what we could tell him that would supplement what he already knew about his major concern, and that, of course, was that he would have sacrificed everything, literally everything, perhaps even his life, and nothing would happen. We asked him, Ed, are you satisfied now that things are happening? And he gave us this broad smile. And then actually Colleen Rowley and Jesselyn Radek were able to fill him in on some of the particulars of the legislation that is now moving forward that he is really largely responsible for. So that was very warm. It was also the case that when we walked into that room and he was already there, when he saw Tom Drake, Tom being the whistleblower from NSA who went through channels and was actually persecuted and not prosecuted by the Department of Justice, but when he revealed the abuses going on at NSA, they turned the tide on him and accused him of 10 felonies, 35 years worth of prison ahead of him. And when the case was dismissed, the judge in Maryland said, look, you Department of Justice lawyers should be ashamed of yourselves. Don't ever bring a case like this before me again. So why do I mention that? Well, because Edward Snowden mentioned in his very first interview in Hong Kong that the reason he got out of Dodge, so to speak, was because he saw what happened to a fellow who tried to go through channels, namely Tom Drake. So there they are together.
Right, but I had Tom out here at the UCLA Hammer Forum that I moderate recently, and he made it very, very clear that he did not take any documents out of the NSA, not a thing. In fact, they tried to nail him by reclassifying something that was declassified that he happened to have in his possession. So isn't there a fundamental difference here that Edward Snowden seems to have taken a treasure trove of documents and from the NSA?
That's exactly right. Yeah. What he wanted to do was to fulfill his obligation under the oath he took to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that included the Fourth Amendment as far as Ed Snowden was concerned. He was part of the gross violations of the Fourth Amendment. And when he realized that and his conscience sort of pricked him, he said, you know, I need to find some way to let the other Americans know about this. And the only way I can do that is not by doing what Thomas Drake did, try to report these abuses through channels. No, I need to go abroad and do it there. And he very artfully set up this secure communication system with Greenwald and Poitras, and did his thing in Hong Kong. Now, what was really interesting about this is that it's very clear to me that clever and smart and well planning ahead as he was, after Hong Kong, when he gave the material over, he had no real forward plan. As for Greenwald and Poitras, you know, they're not social workers, they're journalists, so they went home and wrote their stories. And there's Ed Snowden, all along with the Chinese closing in on him in Hong Kong. So the rescue? WikiLeaks. This is a big story. WikiLeaks sent down Sarah Harrison, one of Julian Assange's lieutenants, and she worked something out so that he could get a ticket via Moscow back to down to Latin America, where he had been offered asylum. Now, the supreme irony, of course, is that the U.S. withdrew his passport, and when he got to Moscow, he had to wait for 5 weeks or so in the interim lounge there at Sheremetyevo Airport. And finally, he sought asylum in Russia. Russia decided that they'd obey international law this time, granted him the asylum. Bottom line, he could not possibly be in a place more safe for him than he is right now. And when I asked him, I asked Ed Snowden, I said, Ed, are you aware that just 4 days ago, the head of the former head of the NSA and CIA, Mike Hayden, had very broadly hinted that you should be put on the kill list, and that a minute later, the head of the House Intelligence Committee chimed in with, yeah, I can help you on that. Are you aware of that? And Ed said, yeah, I am. He kind of winced and said, yeah, I keep up on all that stuff. So he's well informed. He has a computer there. And, of course, he's keeping very close track on what's happening as a result of his disclosures.
So how does he feel about being in a country led by Putin, who is hardly a champion of democracy? He's basically shut down the press, controlled the judiciary. He basically regulates the oligarchs, and he essentially it's a sort of, you know, KGB incorporated country, you know, largely led by a political gangster.
Well, Ian, I'd ask you to put yourself in Ed's place. He achieves his aim. He's safe. The only possible place he could be this safe is in Russia, where the head of the CIA is not going to send in drones, and the head of the army is not going to send in SEAL Team 6. So I think that Ed Snowden's perspective here is that that he's grateful. Mm-hmm. He's grateful that in this case, Putin decided to take the high road, obey international law, and take him in for a year. Now, further than that, you know, I don't think Snowden's all that seized with what else is going on in Russia, nor do I think he should be at this particular point in time. And for those who say that he's under Russian control, well, he's under Russian protection, and Putin's not going to let a damn thing happen to Ed Snowden, and that's to his credit. But under their control, I didn't sense that. I didn't sense that at all, and neither does Ed Snowden.
But how does Snowden feel about, maybe he's not aware of how much the focus has shifted away from the original revelations about the metadata collections and spying on Americans that led to a very close vote in the House. And you mentioned that you talked to him about bills underway to curb the NSA's abuses. It seems that of late, every day, there's a new revelation of spying abroad. And as our first guest, who was a former lawyer for Lon Snowden, Edward's father, was Bruce Fine, was pointing out that spying on Angela Merkel is not a violation of American law. And all the focus has been lately on NSA's behavior abroad, which is what they're going to reform in the in the bill. They're not going to apparently address what the NSA is doing domestically, which is where the real violations are. And Glenn Greenwald has basically promised the worst is yet to come. So there's no question that the press's focus is going to be on all of these sensational revelations involving foreign intelligence, as opposed to the real story, which is what's happening here at home.
Well, that's a very good point. Dianne Feinstein, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is really giving hypocrisy a bad name here. She's been the cheerleader for gross violations, I would say the trashing of the Fourth Amendment. But now she's in high dudgeon. She doesn't like the notion that Angela Merkel's Handy, that's what the Germans call it, Das Handy, her little cell phone is being monitored. Well, give me a break. You know, give me a break. That is legal under U.S. law. Trashing the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution is blatantly illegal and a violation of her oath to defend the Constitution. So you know, this is a very good point, and the distinction is very important to draw, especially for an intelligence officer. I know what you can get from intercepting communications. The only question with respect to our work abroad is, you know, whether there's any sense of proportionality here, any weighing of the potential risks. Are we doing this simply because we have all the money in the world to do it and all the technology that permits us to do it? Or are we focusing our effort on real terrorist plots? Now, one German who was in Washington this week commented, I quote, "Of course, we are not considering our chancellor as a terrorist," period, end quote. Well, okay, that says it all.
So what do you think will happen then? I mean, apart from the fact that we're probably none of these bills seem to be addressing the real issues over NSA domestic spying, and if more of these sensational stories about abuses of the NSA's, well, not the abuses, it's what they do. I mean, they're in the business of signals intelligence, and it just seems that because they have such an enormous capability, they're just doing what they can do rather than thinking about the consequences. But that seems to indicate a lack of political control. Maybe Alexander will have to take the bridge of the Starship Enterprise with him into retirement, and maybe Clapper is going to be sacrificed for his constant lying to the Congress. But it doesn't look like anything good's going to come out of this legislatively. And as I say, more is going to come from Glenn Greenwald. So in a year's time, where do you think when Snowden's asylum's up in Moscow, what do you think's going to happen?
Well, in a year's time, I see Snowden being treated like Daniel Ellsberg is treated now. And I'm not saying saint, and I'm not saying hero. I'm saying patriot, a defender of our Constitution. Now, again, the distinction, abuses within our country, crass abuses of our constitutional rights, they need to be reined in. Abroad, that's a different sort of question. It's just kind of adult supervision being necessary there, excesses being always excesses. So what I would suggest here is what I've been suggesting to European interviewers, and that is this. The West Europeans are in high dudgeon now. This is the latest of a series of abuses and usurpations. They were cajoled into kidnapping people for us, putting them in black prisons on European soil, having them subjected to what we call enhanced interrogation techniques, which, by the way, is a direct literal translation of Verschärfte Vernehmung, from the Gestapo handbook, enhanced interrogation technique. They did all that. Now, in this latest indignity, how are they going to react? What I've been appealing to them to do is to, it's their turn. My father and his generation drove fascists out of Europe. Now it's their turn. We have no experience. We have no historical perspective on what it's like to live under fascism. And what I'm saying here is that when you have the government and the intelligence services and the secret services and the corporations and the Congress and the media all enmeshed in this complicity, you have incipient fascism and do not blanch before the word. What I'm appealing to the West Europeans to do is to educate us, to tell us how dangerous this is, this incipient fascism, what happened to them, and give us some lessons from history as to how we can stop it before it's too late.
Well, just in closing, Ray McGovern, there also seems to be this other component, which is a form of right-wing welfare, the privatization of public service. We know our politicians go through the revolving door and cash in public service for private gain. And we also know that the privatization mania has taken over since Ronald Reagan taken over the intelligence business. I think 70% of the budget goes to these private entities that, like the one that Snowden worked for, that gets 98% of its money from the federal government. We also saw the crash of the website for the healthcare.gov because these people basically what is referred to in your part of the world as beltway bandits. So I did an interview recently with CIA officer Bob Baer, who made the argument that he thought that Snowden was a Russian intelligence asset going back to 2009, and that's what he thinks is happening. But he also went ballistic on the privatization of intelligence and said that that's why all this NSA, what the real subtext of all this NSA spying abroad is, not so much on what Merkel ordered from the delicatessen on a cell phone, but economic intelligence. And that's because private entities are more interested in economic intelligence than traditional national security targets.
Well, Bob is right. It's explicit in the NSA documents that economic advantage is sought vis-a-vis Japan and Brazil, diplomatic advantage vis-a-vis everybody else. So the economic advantage is factual. With respect to contractors, well, you know, it has to do with money. And if a contractor is hired, for example, to evaluate how dangerous Iran is to U.S. interests, and the contractor knows full well what the answer could be that the contracting officer and his outfit want, then you don't have what we used to have. And that is an intelligence outfit that had an analysis division that spoke truth to power, told it like it is. What you have are people make a lot of money by serving up to the government what they think the government needs to hear. Now, besides all that, you have people in Bob Baer's previous discipline, the case officers and the spies, running all over the world and not even being staffers, not even being government employees anymore, and working all kinds of their imaginative mischief. So it's a real problem, and the problem is mostly the money. If we took the money that we spend, the excessive money we spent on intelligence and defense, there would be no problem with food stamps. There would be no problem with building our schools or our infrastructure. Our priorities are all askew, and you have it right on the head. It's because the folks in our Congress are on the take. They're profiting magnificently, and they're not caring very much about the common person.
Well, Ray McGovern, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under seven U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. He currently leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. And in 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. He recently met with Edward Snowden in Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the filmmakers of the new film, The Square.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, from the dunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Boy, Adizi lit the poof. And it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jahan Nujaim, who is an Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her films Control Room, Pangea Day, and Startup.com, which won the 2001 Grand Jury Prize. Her latest film, The Square, was recently awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary, and it has just opened in Los Angeles and New York. And also joining us is the producer of The Square, Karim Amer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jahan Nujaim and Karim Amer.
Thank you for having us.
And Jahan, let me begin with you. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, is in Cairo, where he met with the generals, where he expressed optimism about a return to democracy in this incredibly divided country. What's your sense of, I mean, what's he talking about? I mean, these generals, didn't they just hire, bring back one of the most hardline amongst their number?
I think that the issue with U.S. policy in the past is that we, and I speak as both an American and an Egyptian, we as Americans have always picked a winner, and we've always betted on the winner rather than the process. And we've talked about the process, supporting the process of democracy, but we need to see that happen. And there are people that are in the transitional government in Egypt that are forward-thinking and, make sense. But the problem is having a constitution where the military leadership is above all is going to be a major problem in any future leadership in Egypt. And if you watch the film, the film that we just made, The Square, you see that people are back in the streets time and time again fighting against fascism, whether the face of that fascism is Mubarak or the military or an Islamic regime that was using the tools of democracy to establish another dictatorship, which was Morsi's regime. The hope for his visit is that he stays true to what America says they want to do, which is support the process. But it really remains to be seen.
And Karim, what's your sense of whether or not this roadmap for eventual return to democracy, which the government has, this interim government has published, but of course this is a government that came in what's effectively a coup. What's your sense of where that is that a real possibility of a return to democracy? I mean, Morsi goes on trial tomorrow, does he not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's happened in Egypt is to understand where we are is to understand where we've come from, and I think that Egypt has been in a situation where the events have bubbled to certain levels once in a while in the last 3 years, where they galvanized a lot of international attention. And we are, we're rushed to make a decision about what is happening right now in Egypt and, like, what is the one-line answer or solution. And I think that what the film shows is that it's about the through lines. It's not just about what happened on January 25th. It's not just about what happened this summer. It's about understanding all the steps in between. And I think that what's happened in Egypt, if we want to start talking about the coup, the coup didn't just start this summer. The coup started when 6 months after Mubarak steps down, we had tanks running over innocent protesters. So the coup, I think, is when the world's attention stops listening and stops looking at infractions on human rights and on the democratic process. And so when 2.5 years, when 2 years later, we have this summer, 1,000 people being killed by a military regime. What do we expect? I mean, you know, when we let them get away with it, with running over 26 people in, just in 2011, we allowed for that situation to exist. So I think that what needs to happen is, and what people in Egypt are starting to try to fight for, regardless of what the government is doing, is an attempt to hold power more accountable. And I think that that's one of the messages that the film shows. And I think that that's one of the things that these, you know, disorganized popular movement all over the world are all starting to try to achieve for it. How do we hold power accountable in the 21st century?
And again, Jahar Najem, the Egyptian-American director of the new documentary feature that's just opened in Los Angeles and New York, The Square. Karim mentioned people's attention. Of course, that's such an irony that the uprising that continues to bubble beneath the surface has receded from the headlines. And while there was so much attention on Egypt during the original Tahrir Square revolution or uprising against Mubarak, one wonders where all of that sympathy and enthusiasm that was felt abroad for the Egyptian people, why it wasn't the same sympathy was not felt towards the Syrian people who rose up against a similar dictator who, in fact, turned his guns on them. So are we fickle? What's going on here? Because it feels like your movie is it's very needed. We need to be reminded of this recent history, surely.
Well, thank you. I think it's absolutely crucial that this film is released and is released as widely as possible now to a worldwide audience and to an American audience, because it is so important to understand what we're supporting and not supporting beyond our borders. And here in the news, we do. We only get the sort of million-man march. We get the bloodiest battle when, you know, it's true that when it bleeds, it leads. But we never truly understand what it takes to get to that million man march or why that bloody battle happens. You never understand from the perspective of the people how we get there. So I think what we've hoped for, managed to do in the film is never see the Gandhi or the Martin Luther King as they feel completely alone in their struggle. You always see them when they've actually been successful. And so our hope with this film is to take you on the ground so that you truly understand some of the forces at play across the Middle East and across the uprisings that are happening around the world right now. It really is about this struggle and what it takes to make change for something bigger than yourself.
Well, of course, the American Revolution took decades, in fact. The Civil Rights Movement, you mentioned Martin Luther King. They're still trying to reverse some of what he brought about. The 1965 Voting Rights Act is now under assault. So it's not like those that oppose revolutions, you know, fold easily, is it?
I think where the film leaves off on is this idea that we're not fighting to bring in a leader. We're not fighting to bring in just one political party. We're fighting to build a conscience within society. And what that conscience is the understanding that if we want change, we have to live for that change. And we have to understand the cost of that change. And no great change happens without people actively participating to provide for that platform of change to happen. You know, I think that people in Egypt have grown frustrated with the political process, whether it's the military or the Muslim Brotherhood, whoever's involved. If, you know, people are now starting to feel like they need to take power into their own hands and that no one leader is going to come fix all the problems of the country. It's very similar in a very different sense to what happened in this country with the election of Obama, where people felt that Obama was going to come into power and fix all the problems in one big swoop. That's just not how it happens. We have this false understanding of how change works, and you know, and we have these preset notions of, you know, the people come down, the dictator's removed, then democracy flourishes. Democracy is not just an election. Democracy is a process, and it's about an active citizenry participating in that process. And I think that the film shows that kind of struggle on an ongoing basis of history as it's unfolding. And we hope that, you know, people, when they watch the film, it's been amazing that the reactions is, you know, people seeing that the successes and failures of change in Egypt is part of an interconnected global struggle, that there is this moment in history that we're witnessing now where there's an attempt to rewrite the social contract, where people power is trying to redistribute the distribution of power that exists, and to realize that the battle in one square in the world isn't in a remote thing, that it's about the interconnectedness of these squares and the pursuit of a global conscience.
And Jahan, what the extent to which the Muslim Brotherhood, in effect, you get the feeling that it became a self-fulfilling prophecy, that the notion that Islamists are only interested in one man, one vote, one time, as what happened in the coup against the FIS in Algeria that led to a bloody civil war. Clearly, that's not happening in Egypt, although there's been a lot of bloodshed. But is there a ground in which the secular and the religious can work in harmony, or have the military, by essentially, you know, reacting to a self-fulfilling, have they made a self-fulfilling promise here that Islamists are incompatible with democracy?
I think it's absolutely crucial that the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists are part of the creation of the future constitution and leadership in Egypt. We had this incredible moment that happened on June 30th, which was not taken advantage of in the right way. We had people in the millions coming down in Egypt, and this will go down in history as the first time in the most populous country in the Arab world, people came down and said, we do not want a leadership using religion to create another dictatorship. Religious people, devoutly Muslim people coming down and saying, we elected Morsi, but he has not performed. He has really tried to create another dictatorship by taking on legislative and judicial powers. And that I think will be remembered in the future. However, what the military did after that in terms of the massacre that happened was really taking that incredible movement and once again making martyrs of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist population in Egypt.
And again, I'm speaking with Jahan Nujaim, the Egyptian-American documentary filmmaker of The Square, which just opened in Los Angeles and New York, along with the producer of the film, Karim Amer. Jahan, the film obviously is very important in as much as we've discussed that, you know, the public is somewhat fickle. They've lost interest and it's receded from the headlines. But the revolution continues in Egypt. What is the in terms of getting a national audience after it opens in it's opening now in New York and in Los Angeles, but presumably it's going to go nationwide. What are you hoping for the American people to respond here? What's your hope in terms of an American audience seeing the film and then what happens?
Well, we've had some incredible screenings actually at high schools and colleges, and the kids have come up to me afterwards and said, you know, I never really followed what was happening in the Middle East, but for me, this film is not about the Middle East. I felt very alive watching it because I felt connected to these characters that were fighting for something bigger than themselves and fighting for what they believed in, and they felt like they could actually make change in their country. They felt connected to that change in a way that I feel like we've lost in the U.S. We romanticize what happened and we think back to what happened during the civil rights movement. And I feel like what we're covering in this film is really very much the civil rights movement of our time and representative of a zeitgeist of this time, of what's happening in various places in the world where people are standing up to claim their rights and change the social contract between people and the government. So our hope for this film is that people who are not only interested in what's happening in the Middle East, but people that are interested in change and how change actually happens will be interested in watching this film. The film has, and people who are who think about these issues of holding power accountable wherever you are, whether you're in the Middle East or whether you're in the U.S. Now, what we're doing with the film is we've opened it now in New York at the Film Forum. It has two more weeks there, and we have an opening in L.A. At the Lemley and at the Sundance Theater in on Sunset, and that will continue playing. And then we will open it in a number of theaters in the middle of January, and that will be timed at the same time to go along with a national release across the United States, and we're on the cusp of announcing that deal. But if you go to thesquarefilm.com, you can see where the screenings are happening nationwide across the U.S. and across the world. We're also currently trying to get the film through censorship in Egypt. The film is critical of about everybody that you could think of. It's critical of the military. It's critical of the Brotherhood. It's critical of Mubarak. So it doesn't it's from the perspective of these revolutionaries that have been fighting for the last 3 years, and but we've gotten some great news from you know, our characters in Egypt have said that the accolades about the film and the fact that we have won the audience award at two major festivals in the U.S. and Canada. We've won the audience award at the Sundance Festival, and we won the audience award at the Toronto Film Festival, both big festivals that it's played at, that this news has reached Egypt, and our character in the film, Ahmed, who's this magical, charismatic character, has basically said that this kind of press that has gotten out about the film is going to make it unstoppable in Egypt. So, we're very grateful to the kinds of screenings and the press and to you now. It's really helped. It's going to help the film get out in Egypt in a major way.
I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank both Jahan Najim, the Egyptian-American documentary film director, best known for her films Control Room, which won the 2001 Grand Jury Prize. Her latest film, The Square, was recently awarded the Sundance Audience Award for World Cinema Documentary, and it's just opened in Los Angeles and New York. And along with her, of course, was producer of The Square, Karim Amir. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who'll ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and the slant here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes out in the